Shrink Wrap Radio number 390, a scientific and phenomenological exploration of meditation with Dr. Adeline Van Wanning.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My guest today is Dutch psychiatrist Dr. Adeline Van Wanning, whose new book, The Less Dust, The More Trust, outlines her experiences in a unique 3-month meditation project that combined meditation and science. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Adeline Van Wanning, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much, David.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you on the show all the way from the Netherlands, I might add. And I've been enjoying reading your remarkable book, which describes your participation in something called the Shamatha Project. So tell us a bit about the background and structure of the Shamatha Project. And yes, am I saying that correctly?
Yes, the Shamatha Project. That's okay. indeed the way to say it. And I feel so honored with your invitation to talk about this.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, the Shamatha Project is a large international meditation combined with research project. And I've been a guinea pig in that. So I was a participant and participated in one of the 2 3-month retreats that were involved. They were in 2007, thorough and rigorous research setup. It was in the Rocky Mountains in Colorado, with 2 groups of guinea pigs. And it was officially, to say it in the scientific terms, a longitudinal, randomized, waitlist controlled study. And that was quite special that it was set up in such a great and thorough way.
Yes. So you were in the Rockies, I believe, at a retreat center that some listeners might be familiar with. I believe it's called Shambhala, is that
right? Yes, that's right, the Shambhala Mountain Center in Red Feather Lakes.
Yes, and it looked beautiful. And you actually had to apply and to pay to be in the project. How many people got through the screening process?
On the whole, 60 persons participated. And they were divided in 2 groups of 30. So that stands for this randomized waitlist controlled study. There were 2 groups of 30 persons who could be compared. And one of the groups was the control group for the ones who did already the meditations.
Okay. And then later the control group got to go through the process.
Exactly.
Do I have that right?
They didn't
want to deprive them of the benefits of...
No, it was good to know that in advance. Those who were the group for the controls and who were actually flown in to do the measurements in the period that the first group in spring did their meditation retreat. So they knew that they would come back in the fall.
And were you in the first group or the second group?
I was in the second group.
Okay. And what were the screening criteria that they used to select participants?
Well, it was interesting that we were a group in the middle, so to say. There has been much research on very highly trained monks and nuns who have been training for many, many decades sometimes. And there has been much research for people who did a week retreat or a few days retreat. So this was 3-month retreat, and the selection criteria required that the participants had quite some meditation experience, but still were living not in a sort of a monastic setting, but in society with their jobs and families and so. And then they needed to have done at least 3 retreats of 5 days. So that was a sort of baseline.
Yeah.
And of that, one should have been a shamatha retreat with Alan Wallace. And then we had to make a very thorough application form of 10 pages about meditation practice, health, things, goals, motivation, and also a psychological testing over the telephone.
Uh-huh.
So quite some precautions. Yeah.
So the psychiatrist got subjected to psychological testing.
Exactly.
Well, lucky you passed.
I was looking to pass. Yeah, it was one of the things was also involved. Would the participants be able to tolerate such a long time of silence and relative solitude? So that was an important thing, because that was new for all of us.
I'm glad to hear that you passed the psychological testing, because psychotherapists are, in the general imagination, we're all screwed up, and in movies we're often portrayed as very damaged.
very true. Yeah.
And you've been a long-time meditator, having worked in at least several Buddhist tradition, so I can see that you were well qualified, even though you described yourself as the middle, and I suppose given the two extremes, you would be in the middle, although to me you seem like you already were pretty advanced.
Well, I've never really lived in a monastic setting, so I have done quite some retreats through the years of 1 week, 2 weeks, but this was for me the first time of 3 months.
Yes. Now, the leader, you already mentioned Alan Wallace, who was there were two main leaders of the project, Alan Wallace, PhD,
right,
who lived as a monk in a Tibetan a monastery for 14 years. And then the scientific, the person in charge of all the science surrounding this was Clifford Sarin, PhD, neuroscientist from the University of California, Davis. And he handled the science part. Actually, I had the opportunity to hear Dr. Wallace speak at a Buddhist happiness conference in San Francisco several years ago.
Yeah.
I was very impressed by his clarity, and I think I have one of his books as well. And ever since, I've meant to invite him to be a guest on this show. Mm. So, and I just never got around to it, but I think, you know, reading your book has lit a fresh fire under me to pursue him and see if I can do that.
Well, please do. Yeah. That would be wonderful. Yeah.
So he functioned as the meditation guide in the project and led the group through a variety of mindfulness practices. Maybe you can give us a brief overview of these practices.
Yes. And first I'll say that shamatha stands for concentration, calm practice.
Okay.
And it leads, there are many kinds of shamatha, and they lead generally to relaxation, stability of attention, vividness of perception, and they are seen as complementary to insight practices. And these shamatha practices lend themselves well for research, as they are quite structured.
And do they come from the Tibetan tradition?
They come generally, you could say, as we have been taught, from the Buddhist general tradition, also before the earlier Theravada, Mahayana traditions that came in a way before the Tibetan traditions. But but this shamatha also existed before the Buddha. It is a very old kind of meditation that has some forms of elaborations in many wisdom traditions, this concentration, calm. And it can actually be taught in quite a universal, universal way, not bound to a specific wisdom tradition, and mm-hmm. you can see them in a research context as attention and emotion regulation strategies.
Okay, so maybe you can give us a bit more of an overview of those practices, because you actually recorded a variety of sort of guided meditations by Dr. Wallace. So there was the mindfulness practice, and then there were, I think, four sort of attendant, and I've forgotten the terminology, but things having to do with the heart and so on.
Right.
Give us an overview of those, if you would.
Yeah, so actually we did 10 kinds of shamatha, a couple of them with a focus of mindfulness, specifically attention practices with a focus in the body, the breath, and these could be the complete body, specifically aiming at the abdomen and at the nostrils. So focused attention. And then to the mind, what's happening in the mind, settling the mind in its natural state, which also offers insights into workings, patterns of the mind.
Yeah, that's a phrase that recurs throughout the book, settling the mind into a natural state.
Yes.
That seems to have a many levels of meaning.
That's true. And that was actually my favorite. It was also connecting, with my interest in the mysteries of the mind. And from this interest, also my choosing my work will have come. But that was a very interesting connection to getting more understanding from quite a different dimension than Western psychology, psychiatry. This sort of exploration in the mind, in the space of mind, and what arises in it.
That's yes. And I interrupted you, I think, as you were about to go into talking about the other four.
Okay, yes. And then there is awareness of awareness practice. So these are five, what I have named now. And then there were, like you said, the four qualities of the heart.
Yes.
Loving kindness, compassion, empathetic joy, and equanimity. And then there was Tonglen. That's a specific Tibetan practice of, giving and receiving, to say it very briefly in an emotional sense.
So these were long days of meditation. You ate in silence. Were there also walking meditations?
Yeah, it was mainly silence indeed. And the day was structured with two periods that we shared in the meditation hall with Alan Wallace, half an hour every morning with one of these heart qualities, and every afternoon mostly 1 hour, 1.5 hour with one of these focused attention practices, together with exchange and questions and more explanations and Dharma talk from him. And then there were the three meal times. And then, of course, there were many hours a day for meditation. And many of us did that in their rooms. But it could also be done in the group, in this meditation hall. And indeed, walking was taking a walk in these beautiful Rockies was certainly also stimulated as a kind of a meditation space.
Especially for someone from the Netherlands, right? The lowlands, from the lowlands to the Rockies.
it was indeed, breathtaking to be there. Yeah. May I add one thing about these meditations, which I find important, because I just named the focused, the focus of mindfulness has been in these practices. But next to that is an important aspect, the monitoring and the the quality control, the metacognition that you train in the witnessing, in seeing how I practice and getting back to the focus when I'm distracted and adapting, getting back all the time to what is the focus.
Yes, I was struck as I was reading the book at how finally you were able to sort of slice and dice the practices and the levels of awareness that you went through. As you look back, were there major phases or stages that you went through in your meditation experience during the Shamatha experience?
Yeah, I think I started with a sort of a honeymoon feeling.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
It was delightful to be there and to take part. And I didn't know other people, that it was something very special about that. And having the time and being to surrender to days full of meditation, I can imagine that's not everybody's cup of tea, but I really loved that. And then, a sort of next phase is when the reality comes in of, seeing how often with these focused practices I have been distracted, when it sounds like a very simple task to focus on your breath in the belly. And in a way it is, but we are wired in a way that this distraction comes in and comes in and again and again and again. And that takes some time to adapt to to seeing that this is part of the game, and being realistic about that in your aspirations, and just do it and come back to the focus. And 100 or 1,000 times, and attuning, and being present in the moment.
So maybe at first you had a kind of heroic attitude towards that, like I'm going to master this, and my mind is not going to wander. And then it sounds like later you moved into an
more
acceptance.
Humble.
You were humbled and kind of came to embrace that as part of what is.
That's right. It's more attuning and being realistic and not having these expectations, and not be disappointed about what it is, what is possible, and still have compassion for oneself. This is a general thing.
It's so hard not to have those expectations, though, isn't it? And you talk about grasping, and I guess that's an aspect of the grasping mind. That we want to overcome, achieve, etc.
That's right. These are two main themes: the inner distractions. Going away from this focus into a train of thought or daydream or some perception that strikes you, something that you hear, and then coming back. And the second thing, indeed, is the grasping and the wanting control, or the preference or not preference of one thought, and identification with a thought. And with that you get in other trains of thoughts that go to the referent or to memories, and then you are gone from the focus again.
Yes, and the title of your book is interesting. It's called "The More Trust, the Less Dust, the More Trust." Tell us a little bit about that title. Where does that come from, and what does it mean to you?
Yeah, Well, it was you asked about these walks in these huge and fantastic spaciousness of the sky above the Shambhala mountain center and these valleys. This was actually a sort of a mantra, a little one-liner that came up during retreat when I went for such a walk. And the dust refers to an expression in one discourse of the Buddha about beings with little dust in their eyes, mm-hmm. meaning beings who will be able to understand the Buddhist Dharma teaching, what is referring to the truth of phenomena, the truth of who we are. And there's a lot of dust around that.
So it's got something to do with seeing clearly.
Exactly, yeah.
But then there's this other part, the more trust. And so trust in who or what or both.
trust, yes, this feels like a sort of a general basic trust. Trust in as a sort of ease with what is. I have also experienced this participation as, to say it in Western psychological terms, as a increase of sort of basic trust and acquired secure attachment.
Yes, yes. I was just thinking attachment theory. So
yes, in that sense,
as if you had the ideal mothering.
In a way, these practices support a sort of acquired, mothering over oneself. Mm-hmm. A sort of talking about this loving kindness, compassion, empathy, these are qualities that we practice toward others, but in a way also toward ourselves, in the sense of being more realistic, not have these endless expectations we were talking about. That was in relation to the practices, but so often this is something that is so limiting, self-criticism. And
I realized as I was reading what you had written that trust is, it's such a central dynamic. And I'm aware of all the distrust in myself. I mean, if I were there, I would be, who's this guy, Alan Wallace, and does he know any more than I know, and who's he to tell me what I should be doing, and does this stuff really work, and am I capable of meditating for 30 days, and so there'd be all sorts of trust issues, I would think, that would arise.
Certainly, I recognize that. And I think this selection, I would have dropped out if I wouldn't have started it to participate if I didn't have some initial trust in the sense that this would be a good thing for me to do and have the minimal trust in the setup of the project and, of course, in the person of Alan Wallace,
Yeah, but despite that initial commitment, did you find any sorts of resistance cropping up in yourself as the process went along? In other words, what dust did you have to deal with to get to more trust?
Yes, there was a lot of dust, and the dust is gradually refining, but still dust, and the instruments for recognizing the dust is also refining. If you understand what I mean.
Yes, I do.
And certainly there were, there was a lot of dust in all these kind of, defenses, sort of micro processes. I haven't had during those 3 months moments of what am I doing here? I want to get out or something like that.
You did not have that.
Not in that sense, but resistances in. I have to go again, and so many hours today, and may I now go out or just have chocolate and not meditate? That kind.
Okay.
That are more sort of micro, little inner dynamics that were grist of the mill of the practices, actually, the sort of determination. All the time sort of balancing also in that. There was also a wonderful sense of loyalty among us as a group, even if we didn't know each other socially. Just you get to know each other mainly in silence during meal times. But taking part in this huge project,
there was a sort of energy that you felt being in the silent group with a shared commitment.
Yes, very much. And knowing that this project had been prepared for many, many years by tens of people who put their heart in it and millions of dollars in it also.
Yeah, that moves us into the scientific research that was conducted during the Shamatha project, which was truly massive. Take us through the structure of that in terms of the various sorts of physical monitoring, self-report, survey instruments, and so on.
Yeah. Yes, this was huge. All kinds of multidisciplinary methods. And I'm aware as I'm talking that I can name them sort of from the outside, like many methods of cognitive and affective neuroscience, stress, immune, biomarkers, etc. But from the inside, as the participant, it was, 3 times. So this was two days in the beginning, 2 days in the middle, and 2 days and at the end of the 3 months. We were subjected to a very full schedule of all these research things that meant 15 vials of blood going 4 times a day, putting some saliva in a little tube and running to the refrigerator to put it on the right spot. Indeed, like you named, this EEGs, tests during attention tests during meditation, so with an electrode cap with 19 6 channels, electrodes on the scalp, video interviews we did also 3 times. We did also audio interviews every 2 weeks, so that was 6 times. And we had to fill in a daily experience questionnaire, self-report, which was 7 pages a day, including what kind of meditations we had done, for how long, our emotions, all kind of scorings about moods, about physical experiences, psychological experiences, dream log next morning. So indeed, like you say, massive, lots of tools and instruments have been used.
Yes.
Also in combination, and there were some innovative combinations in that.
Innovative combinations.
Yeah.
Yeah. No wonder you referred to yourself as a guinea pig, somewhat in jest, but there was a lot of poking and prodding and measuring going on. And
absolutely, yeah.
And did you experience that as dust in the process?
That's an interesting question. It was, of course, in these days of the assessments, it was distracting from doing the practices many hours a day. There was not much time for that. But in the all-inclusive setup of being a participant in this project, it was, it was part of the setup. So, no, that was not dust. I have the idea. My association with dust is more all these inner processings of dust and defenses and reactivities and inner distortions of perceptions and stuff.
Yes. I understand that so much data was collected that it's still, several years later, still not all evaluated.
That's
is that
really
right?
True. That's yeah. true. And but, it's more material is adding as the longitudinal aspect of the project means that we have had, after 5 months and after 60 months, we have had follow-up research. Mm-hmm. So we received a laptop at home with a number of the same tests that we did in the Shambhala Mountain Center. And there has just been awarded a large Templeton Prize grant to the project, which means that now, so after 6 or 7 years after this, that the main the large retreats in 2007, that we will have a new follow-up round.
This puts me in mind of research that was conducted with astronauts to see, you know, how they could stand isolation in outer space and so on, and speculation about long space travel. So this was like inner space.
Yes, very true. Inner space travel. And yes. Alan Wallace used also to compare it to setting up a platform with a telescope. That's in a way a good metaphor for these shamatha practices. Mm-hmm. So it is polishing the tools, and it's getting your whole inner perception and outer perception apparatus in a much better shape of effectiveness and clarity.
Yes. Now, are you aware of any of the major findings that have emerged so far, you know, from a scientific point of view?
Yes, much has been published now in quality peer-reviewed journals, and some people have made already PhDs. And yes, I can tell you a bit about what has come out until now.
Good.
And about the research questions. So these are briefly: can attention be trained through these focused attention meditation practices? And how can, in what way, if do these loving kindness, compassion, and beneficial aspiration support the attention and improve emotion regulation? And then more about psychological function that may go with that. And what are the subjective, behavioral, neural, and physiological correlates of these trainings? And, well, to summarize a few findings, up till now, the findings are very encouraging and impressive, actually. So that's also exciting to read that as a group about what in what we have been contributing.
Yes, that's got to be very reinforcing.
Absolutely, yeah. So these are to name a few aspects: the changes in psychological sense, there is in adaptive functioning has been greatly increasing, and that means various, it's a summarizing concept that includes many self-report questionnaires with increase in psychological well-being, mindfulness, empathy, ego resilience, and decrease in questionnaires about depression, anxiety, neuroticism, problems in emotion regulation. And this was also reaffirmed after 5 months. And then a second thing is on the biological, on the molecular biological level, on the chromosome level, that was a unique unique way of innovative research to explore this in the context of meditation. There were the findings of the enzyme telomerase, which is an enzyme that protects the end of chromosomes. And this is very much connected to health and longevity. And this research, having never been done with meditation, showed a 30% increase in the retreatants compared to the controls. And much of research with this telomerase has been done with persons in chronic stress situations and chronic diseases. And actually, Elizabeth Blackburn won with her research about this telomeres and telomerase a Nobel Prize in 2009. But this was the first time that it was used in a meditation setting with such positive findings.
Yes, you note that that there's been a variety of research projects on meditation in recent years, but that this one is a unique contribution, and I guess particularly in terms of what you just cited about the look at the chromosomal level.
Yeah, that was the first time. It was in 2007. This was as a marker was included. After 2007, there have been now a few more setups. Yeah. And then if I may continue about the outcomes, a few more things. That attention, about the attention, the training showed, the measurements showed that we could better sustain attention after these months, all significantly increased. And there was more refinement and more refined discrimination in seeing small differences in a certain setup.
Yeah, you described setups where you were looking at a computer screen and you had to notice certain stimuli changing, lengths of lines and so on.
Exactly.
And so there was an objective way of press. It's like I had a hearing test just recently, and you have to press the button when you hear the tone.
Yes.
And so there was a way of measuring your attention and whether or not it strayed.
That's right. So, and then in this case, there was a long line and a short line. And the trick was also that the short line got longer in the course of the measurements. So this was right away training our discrimination abilities. And it was easily, one could confuse the length of these lines. Mm-hmm. But,
I know how that goes. I have some brain training software that I played with. I got so discouraged, I stopped using it. But it asks you to make very fine discriminations to the point where it almost felt like, well, you were guessing,
Yes. It stretches your abilities, and that's exactly what it is meant to do. But then you are on the edge of making more errors or being more prudent in not pressing, etc. So you have to find that that edge.
I have to blow my own horn a little bit here. In 1970, I did my doctoral research, and in part it was on meditation and attention. And I had people in a soundproof chamber meditating on a candle flame or on their breath, two different conditions. And they were to press a button every time they had to bring their attention back.
Yeah.
So I feel like, wow, I was ahead of I didn't have all these tools, you know. But boy, have they ever taken it a long ways since then.
Oh, interesting, David. Yeah, that you did that. Yeah.
Well, how have you, a few things. Go ahead.
There was another thing about this attention, that there was a better response inhibition also in this mouse pressing that you are talking about. So not to press, to also the ability to withhold a response. And this suggests less reactivity also in an emotional sense. And then for concluding this brief overview, this in the emotional research about emotion regulation, there was, we got to see actually very disturbing slides and film clips to explain a bit about this research, imagery of the Iraq war. And then in four ways we were measured in the way that of the autonomic nervous system, so our skin skin conductance, breath rate, etc., a storyboard of self-report of emotions about certain happenings, and then at the same time EEG and facial action coding, the FACS measurements. So four things have been correlated, and what came out, for instance, there were less rejection emotions, more increased sadness, more signs of empathy, and increased ability to hold in mind complex and painful realities without pushing them away. And this is connected then with compassion and the inclination to want to help.
I'm really impressed by all the creativity that the science people brought to this project in terms of the variables that they wanted to investigate and the ways that they developed to do that.
Yeah, oh, that's great. You say so. I'll tell them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How have your experiences with the Shamantha Project impacted your own work as a psychotherapist, if at all?
I think I can affirm the findings that I just named. These were, of course, general, but for me personally, it has brought much deepening well-being. And I hope, of course, this radiates in my work as a psychotherapist. In general, I think it has helped me to, for some time, to be in these very simple, clear cut circumstances, and train abilities in the mind, and then widen the scope again, being home in the world. And this has felt to me as a greater ease, resilience, acceptance, and this sort, like I describe in the book, this sort of underlying flow of joy. And this, the training, what I named in relation with the focused attention meditations, the training in taking this reflexivity and meta position. I don't know. You understand what I mean? That this meta position, the step aside.
Right. Do you see any wider implications for society perhaps for people who don't embrace Buddhism or a Buddhist philosophy or vision of the world?
Yes, certainly. Yes, I think, these practices, as I said, the basic in the research setting, you can see them as universal attention and emotion regulation strategies. In that sense, I think that many, many, if not all of us, could benefit of that, but there are certainly special groups of which I'm thinking and of what I'm also writing in the book, and I'm very much motivated to bring these practices in the world. For instance, two persons with what is clearly connected with attention problems, ADHD, ADD, and in more general sense in mental health care. And I think, the question can come up. I'm talking about mindfulness of a focus when I talk about the shamatha. And shamatha is also a lot about mindfulness, and we hear a lot about mindfulness in an applied sense now, isn't it, in the mindfulness-based stress reduction, mindfulness-based cognitive therapies. And I think that is a wonderful broad approach that gives tools for being human, you could say. And then I believe that shamatha can add something to that as a focusing the mind, opening the heart with more specific approaches. And in that sense, going deeper in a way of complementarity to greater insight in reality, in existential way of how we are. And then as a third point, this settling the mind in its natural state practice that focuses on the mind and the mind dynamics and mind patterns. I think that this would be very helpful and supportive for mental health care professionals and also for meditation teachers in general. And actually, I have been giving trainings in that also to psychiatrists and psychologists who are interested in that.
Well, good for you. And I think that's a wonderful summary for us to close with. So, Dr. Adeline Van Wanning, it's been great to speak with you, and I really want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
It has been my privilege, David, and thank you for your very, your deep interest in this subject and how you have dived and immersed yourself into it.
Well, thank you. I feel very seen. Dr. Van Wanning sent me some links to information that you might want to access, so I'll be sure to put these links in the biographical area about Dr. Wanning on the Shrink Wrap Radio website. One of the links is to a pre-publication site about her book. Another is the updated site of the scientific lab of Dr. Sarin, who we discussed. And it has all the information and scientific publications about the Shamatha Project. And then there is a PDF with the beginning pages of the book, about 12 pages worth. And finally, there is an article in the summer issue of the 2011 publication of a journal called Buddha Dharma, with many pictures in it from the retreat of 2007, including a photo of Dr. Van Wanning in her EEG cap and pictures showing the surroundings. And that PDF is about 4 pages in length. In the book itself, Dr. Van Wanning goes into exquisite detail about her internal experiences over the 3-month meditation retreat. Actually, she suggests that retreat is the wrong word, and a better one would be expedition. Just as explorers go off on expeditions of discovery about the physical world, this should be thought of as an expedition into the interior. She also gives considerable background about Buddhist terminology, practices, and history. All in all, this is a very meaty book, which can be enjoyed and learned from on many different levels. A book from many years ago that I've kept on my bookshelf as a sort of reference book is The Three Pillars of Zen by Philip Kaplow. Some of you might be familiar with that book. I think for many of you, this book might also deserve a special place on your bookshelf. So do go to the site to find these links that we've put up. And also, I must say, this is a highly recommended book, especially for those of you who are interested in or who are practitioners of meditation, and or those of you who are students of Buddhism, and or all of you who are interested in neuroscience. As always, if you decide you'd like to order The Less Dust, The More Trust, you can do so using the Amazon.com widget in our right-hand sidebar.
I have a confession to make. I am a shrink wrap radio addict. That's right. Dr. Dave has me totally hooked. I am devouring episode after episode, so I figured it's only fair to make a donation. And, you know, if you're enjoying these shows too, perhaps you should think about making a donation, maybe even just a one-off one. Every little bit helps. Go on, you know it'll make you feel good.
Thank you, Louise, for that very spirited call to action. I'm happy to report that we have a new transcript on the site. It's for episode number 388, William James as Progenitor of Transpersonal Psychology with Mark B. Ryan, Ph.D., and that one is thanks to champion transcriptionist Gloria Ullman. Let me remind you that I recently discovered that I did not have a link on my site to a 15-unit course on crisis and trauma that I participated in for the Zur Institute. So even though it's not really a new course, I have labeled it as new in the show notes as well as in the list of CE courses under the store tab on our site. So all you therapists out there will definitely want to check into that. Now, in addition, I've teamed up with another organization called Ed4Online. That's Ed and then the number 4 and then online. And you will see a banner in the left-hand sidebar on our site that links to them. They specialize in providing course content for employee assistance programs and individuals seeking to explore new careers. They've licensed about 20 shrink wrap radio episodes to use in their courses, but I think they've only put up 10 so far. Now, this is the first time it's possible to get a single CE unit for listening to a single episode. The easiest way to find the one-unit courses based on Shrink Wrap Radio interview is to click on the Ed4Online ad in our left-hand sidebar and then go to the section on their site titled Mental Health and Psychology and scroll down and look for courses where the description starts off with the words Podcast Shrink Wrap Radio. By the way, once again, our message phone number has changed. So if a month goes by without any messages, our service drops the number, and that's what happened. So if you left me a message there sometime not too long ago, and I never responded, that would be why. The new number is 206-309-4707. And finally, let me urge you to vote in the poll on our site that asks whether you like the current transitional music or you would prefer me to return to one of a couple of earlier musical styles. I actually played samples of all three musical styles in the two episodes preceding this one. Those would be number 388 and number 389. You can find the musical samples by scrolling through to the announcements section. That's what I call the segment that you're listening to now, in case you didn't know. And I should add, this will be the last week of that particular poll.
Hi, my name is Judy from County Cork, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
That's a clip I recorded live during a visit to Ireland some years back when I was conducting a workshop there. Judy is not a listener or a guest of Shrink Wrap Radio, but I prevailed on her to give me that sample, which I play from time to time because I love her accent. At least to me, it's an accent. Now let's take a listen to some recent emails from our listener community. And first we hear from John, who writes, "Thanks for the transcript, Dave. Pieter hails lately from my own alma mater." Now, the Pieter that he's referring to is Pieter Rusau, and I sent John a copy of the transcript, which he requested. He goes on to say, "Thanks also for your great, quote, show. There is nothing else like it on the ether. How is your fundraising going? We all realize that it costs money to keep your show on air and that you cannot keep on doing it out of your own pocket. What you really need is a benefactor who believes that what you are doing has great value and who is willing to set up an endowment fund to make sure that your show continues far into the future. Hopefully, just such a person will read this or hear this and contact you. I look forward to listening to your upcoming interviews. All the best for 2014. And that's from John. Okay, potential benefactor, I hope you're listening, or benefactors, please contact me. Next, we hear from champion transcriptionist Gloria, who writes, "I'm currently reading a book, Bereavement Dreaming and the Individuating Soul, by Jerry Grubbs, the Jungian analyst mentioned by Stephen Fox in his interview, and it is so good." And she gives a link here to www.eastsidejung.com. And she goes on to say, "So if you ever were short of an interviewee, LOL. By the way, I really love the recent emails you read out from Ralph in Germany, especially his account of his first experience of a psychiatrist pointing the finger of blame at him for his inability to get along with his father. My experience has been that the therapists I have met starting almost 40 years ago, have collectively embodied all the traits of the diverse and chaotic caregivers of my formative years, and that as the dysfunctions have healed, I have gradually met with increasingly helpful therapists. Funny that. Dr. Dave is my favorite so far, even though you're not a, quote, official therapist. From the information Ralph gave, he was born around 1950, which is the same year I was born. So perhaps our experiences are also reflective of the advancements in the treatment of psychological and psychiatric disorders. One can only hope so, and if the interviews on Shrink Wrap Radio are any indication, the hope has some substance." And she signs, "Hugs, Gloria." Gloria has done so many wonderful transcriptions that I've come to think of her really as a co-creator and collaborator on Shrink Wrap Radio. So I'm proud to acknowledge that publicly, Gloria, and keep up the good work. Next, we hear from Pam, who says, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I've been a fan since Monica Wickman told me about your show at a workshop I did with her and Diane Haug in September. I'm a regular listener now and really enjoy the fantastic guests and your skillful questions and interviewing style. The push for my donation, though, was your interviewing my friend and holotropic breathwork colleague, Mark Ryan. What a great choice. I'm a second career psychotherapist in Houston, and your program really enriches me and my practice. And of course, I talk it up all over the place as well. Sending you all good wishes. Let me think about the promo. I'd have to give some thought as to what I'd say. Most of your on-air promos are very clever. All the best, Pam." And of course, I invite all my contributors to submit a brief audio clip promoting the show and saying why they chose to donate, hoping that it will encourage others and saving me the embarrassment of having to constantly blow my own horn. So it's great to hear that Monica Wickman is helping to spread the word and that Pam is helping to spread the word as well. I thank you both. So once again, I think that better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And our new number is 206-309-4707. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. Adeline Van Wanning, for her sharing about the inner and outer aspects of that 3-month shamatha retreat that she participated in. My next guest will be Jungian analyst Patricia Berry, who will be speaking about the art of psychotherapy and also the online seminar that she'll be conducting with past guest Jungian analyst Robert Bosnack. And by the way, that seminar will be on alchemy, and it's being offered through our partner, the Jung Platform. So until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.